We're now in the fourth year of the Roberts Court. It's beginning to sort of settle in. You know, there's the convention of talking about Supreme Courts by way of the Chief Justice. That sometimes masks what's really going on, but that's the convention. And let me provide a moment of historical context by way of recalling that it's been exactly 40 years since Chief Justice Earl Warren stepped down as Chief Justice. So that was the end of the Warren Court and the beginning of the Burger Court. In between, we had the Rehnquist Court and, of course, now the Roberts Court. I think the popular and perhaps professional picture of the Warren Court is one that's summed up in the phrase judicial activism. It was a busy court. It found a lot of work to do. If it saw a problem, it set out to fix it. That's the way the Warren Court was. John Marshall Harlan, who was often a dissenter in the Warren Court days, complained that it was the kind of court that for every major social ill, the court seemed to find a solution for it. Other people were more charitable. Archibald Cox, for example, at Harvard, made the comment that the Warren Court was really in keeping with what he took to be the mainstream of American history and the spirit of its times. Now, at the time of his retirement as Chief Justice, Earl Warren picked out three opinions that he thought were the most important decisions of the Warren Court. He named Baker versus Carr, that's the reapportionment decision, Brown versus Board of Education, no surprise there, the desegregation decision, and finally, Gideon versus Wainwright, the right to counsel decision. Now, the Warren Court, by and large, it had its friends, it had its enemies, and those who didn't like the Warren Court basically said it was cavalier, it was making it up as it went, it didn't care about doctrine or precedent, pretty much was a freewheeling, loose cannon on deck. And in a sense, the story of the Supreme Court from 1969 to the present time has been one of a struggle between successive Republican presidents, beginning with Richard Nixon and carrying through George Bush, the second Bush, struggle for them to basically remake the face of the Supreme Court. None of them was much of a fan of the Warren Court, and they tried, with mixed success, as it turned out, to make things different. Now, Richard Nixon, for example, put four justices on the court, but they were not all lockstep conservatives. They included, for example, Harry Blackmun, who turned out to be very liberal. Ronald Reagan, more ideological, tried to do what Nixon had not accomplished, but he gave us justices like Sandra Day O'Connor, who clearly was a more moderate justice. The first Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, put two justices on the court, one of them a thoroughgoing conservative, Clarence Thomas, but the other was David Souter, who turned out to be a liberal on the court. Clinton gave us two moderately liberal justices. Then came an interesting period of about 11 years, 1994 to 2005, during which there was no turnover on the court at all, no vacancies. So we began to get a pretty good picture of the so-called Rehnquist Court during that time up to 2005. And certainly if this were a lecture on the Rehnquist Court, which it is not, we could talk about some of the changes that had taken place from the Warren Court period through the Rehnquist Court. For example, the rediscovery of federalism would surely be one of them. I think the erosion of the wall of separation of church and state would be another, and one could extend the list. But by and large, there was a center that held on the Supreme Court in areas that Roe v. Wade was not overturned. Affirmative action survived in the Michigan case. And it was in good part because by this point, there simply was not yet a authentic conservative majority on the court. It still depended on moderate justices like Sandra Day O'Connor. Then came 2005, 4 years ago, that remarkable summer that many of you, I'm sure, remember when we had both Rehnquist and O'Connor depart from the court, one by death, one by retirement, and George Bush put both John Roberts and Samuel Alito on the court. And it looks at that point, if you had a freeze frame of 2005, here are two justices thoroughly vetted by the White House. Each had been a veteran of the Reagan administration as young lawyers, and certainly heightened the prospect that some authentically conservative court would come into being. So the Rehnquist Court passed from history into history. The Roberts Court got underway. And so what I thought we, I hope we'll get a few glimpses of this afternoon is to what extent can we begin to talk about the Roberts Court by way of the interesting decisions that came down in this most recent term. As to the term itself, 75 decisions that were handed down on the merits after argument, something curious is going on because that's only about half of the number of cases the court would have decided, say, 20 years ago, and people are speculating on why the docket seems to be shrinking as it has done. In terms of where the court took its cases from, it took more cases from the Ninth Circuit than any others, and it tended to reverse those decisions. Ninth Circuit has not done very well in the modern court. 4 out of 5 of its decisions were overturned. But before you leap to conclusions, I was surprised in reviewing the statistics on the term to note that every one of the Fourth Circuit decisions that went to the Supreme Court was also reversed this term. And the Fourth Circuit is, by popular tradition, the most conservative of all the circuits. So the Roberts Court defies easy analysis. A term that produced a lot of split opinions. I mean, you may remember that when John Roberts was confirmed, he talked about bringing consensus to the court. He wanted the court to sort of come together. Well, if that was indeed one of his hopes, it didn't happen this term. The court split 5-4 in about 1/3 of all of its cases, almost 25 cases out of the 75. And of the 5-4 decisions this term, about 2/3 of those split along what I would call ideological lines, the fairly familiar groupings of 4 conservatives, 4 liberals, and Justice Kennedy. Now, last term, Kennedy seemed to have been more split between the two camps. I think there were 8 5-4 decisions in which he gave his vote 4 times to the liberals and 4 times to the conservatives a year ago. But in the most recent term, he seems to have settled in more comfortably with the more conservative bloc, because he gave his vote in 11 of 16 cases in which the court split on ideological lines. He was with the right wing of the court. Interesting also to think about agreements among pairs of justices. Court watchers like to sort of see how they pair off, and the highest agreement rate of any pair of justices was, interestingly enough, Roberts and Alito, the 2 justices that came on the court at exactly the same time, the same year, rather, agreed 92% of the time, which is, you know, if you could make a few mistakes and account for the other 8%. Roberts and Kennedy, 86%, almost as high an agreement rate as Roberts and Scalia. So that confirms my sense that in this term, at least, Kennedy was very much with the right wing of the court. If disagreement interests you, the people that disagreed the most often were Stevens and Thomas, who disagreed more than they agreed. Their agreement rate was down about 40%. If you like to rearrange the justices and think in terms of who was in the majority the most often, no real surprise here, it was Justice Kennedy, who was in the majority the leader in this pack. 92% of the time he was on the majority side. So if you want to speculate on whether you should call it not the Roberts Court but the Kennedy Court, you can see why that would happen. Some of the questions that I think might surface, at least implicitly in our discussion this afternoon, in thinking about this term and thinking about the Roberts Court more generally, would include the following. First, can we begin to call this an authentically conservative court? And if we want to call it a conservative court, what evidence would we advance for that? What kind of data would we believe? Secondly, what's the influence of Chief Justice Roberts himself? This is a very smart guy, been very politically active all of his life. I can't believe he is without some sort of agenda that he'd like to pursue in shaping the court's docket and the results. Secondly, would it be useful to compare the 2 conservative pairs of justices? That is to say, should we talk about Scalia and Thomas as a pair, and should we talk about Roberts and Alito as a pair? Fourthly, what about Kennedy? I mean, what is Kennedy's role? He clearly is the most powerful justice, most powerful judge of any kind in America at the moment. He's inherited the role that O'Connor used to have, but it's clear, I think, from what I've told you so far, that he's not as much of a centrist as O'Connor is. And basically, what role does he seek to play, and what role does he play? Fifthly, it's interesting to think about to what extent the court is receptive to non-traditional legal data. I've heard John Roberts talk about how the court ought to talk law, and they ought not to fish around in social science data and all these other things to try to serve as the basis for decisions. In this, the Roberts court would be very different, I think, from the Warren court. Sixthly, what about methodology? Do we now see the sort of now familiar debate on the court about things like originalism and textualism and the like? Well, those are some of the fairly general questions that can be raised. One area that I would like to mention before I begin to pass it on to areas my colleagues will talk about, we don't have on our panel people who are planning to talk about the business docket. John Cannon will talk about the environmental cases, which clearly impact the business community. But let me mention briefly the fact that the Roberts Court has been often characterized as being a pro-business court, that it's a favorable climate for business interests. If that has been true of previous terms, it's hard to say it about this particular term. There were three cases involving federal preemption of state laws. In all three of them, the court rejected the argument that there ought to be preemption. That is to say, in each of the cases, they upheld the state law against the preemption argument. One was the National Banking Act case. The other two were really quite important. One had to do with cigarette advertising, and the other had to do with warning labels on drugs. And the business community and the agencies in question wanted preemption, and they didn't get it. So it's not easy to simply, in a casual kind of way, talk about a pro-business court. Now, one generalization. I'm fascinated by the discussion that you see about minimalism or incrementalism. I think there's kind of a theory going around based on recent terms, we'll see whether it applies to this term or not, that the Roberts Court, rather than plunging to its conservative destination, is getting there by steps. It's a step at a time, therefore incremental. There are examples from this term. George Rutherglen will be talking about the New Haven firefighters case and the voting rights case from Texas. And in each of those, the court stopped short of constitutional rulings, which were hovering in the air, and they decided the case on more narrow grounds. Now, those decisions may be idiosyncratic to the particular cases, or arguably they might be ammunition for those who consider this to be an incrementalist court. And one could talk about examples from some previous terms. Well, I have four theories of incrementalism, and I'll toss them out and see if any of them make any sense to you. One would simply be the word Kennedy, that the conservatives would like to go further and faster, but they're not able to count on that fifth vote, Kennedy's vote, and therefore they have to be a bit more cautious. Secondly would be a concern that now that the other two branches are in the hands of the Democrats, that maybe if the court is too bold and too aggressive, that there might be some kind of lashback. I have to say that theory doesn't persuade me very much, because it's not clear to me what the Democrats could do if they didn't like decisions from the Supreme Court, not likely to impeach any justices. And indeed, given the present state of health care debate and the like, it's not clear that the Democrats would organize to come down hard on the court anyway. Thirdly, it's possible that this is really an extension of a principled view of Roberts himself, that he really is by philosophy an incrementalist, that he believes in minimalist jurisprudence, that he thinks the court ought to husband its capital and not be too bold, lest it find itself being charged with judicial activism the way the Warren Court was. Finally, and this is the view that I think I am somewhat sympathetic to, it's that the incrementalism is tactical. Namely, that there is an agenda to roll back major parts of the Warren Court legacy. The exclusionary rule we'll be talking about in a few minutes. wall of separation between church and state, substantive due process. There are major parts of the Warren legacy to which conservative justices and conservative generally object. And it may well be that if that's the agenda, the conservatives on the court know they've got plenty of time. I mean, if a vacancy on the court occurs, assuming Obama serves a second term, so assuming 8 years altogether, and if it were, as it could well be, Stevens or Ginsburg that leaves the court next, the best Obama can do is replace one liberal with another. That doesn't change things very much. From actuarial or statistical prospects, it's likely to be the end of that second term before anything really substantial could happen, when you maybe Scalia or maybe somebody on that side of the court might retire. And it's at that point the change could come about. So if you take that view of it, the conservatives on the court need be in no hurry. There is, by the way, a case today that you ought to watch. I'm sure you know that the campaign finance case was argued in the court today. And that case is rather arresting because it was argued last spring. They set it for re-argument on a much broader question. They really enlarged the case. And it may well be that they now have McCain-Feingold in their crosshairs, and that may turn out to be a fairly expansive decision. We shall see. Well, those are just some introductory thoughts to try to give you a little bit of historical and jurisprudential perspective. What we will do now is turn to selected areas of the court's term. And I emphasize selective. There's no pretense that we can or should be exhaustive. There are areas of the court's docket worth talking about that simply we're not able to do this afternoon. And what we will do, and I will indicate the sequence now and not make introductions between the speakers. First, we'll have Barbara Armacost, who will be talking about the court's criminal justice docket with particular attention to the exclusionary rule. Then Jonathan Cannon, who will be talking about the court's rather active environmental law docket this term. And then finally, George Rutherglen will focus on two civil rights cases, the New Haven firefighters case and the Voting Rights Act case from Texas. As Andrew said, at the end of our presentation, rather than taking questions or the like, I'll turn it back over to Andrew, we'll adjourn. There will be, I'm told, ample food and drink from the Student Legal Forum's rather generous coffers, so hang around and eat and drink well and fully at the forum's expense. And I'm sure that while you're doing that, the panelists, would be happy to have you come up and chat and ask questions then. So thank you so much for coming, and I'll turn it first to Barbara Armacost.
So of the 75 cases decided this term, which isn't very many, is it? There were 31 cases that could be included under the broad category of criminal justice. That's a lot of cases out of 75. I thought, rather than trying to summarize even a few of them in detail, or in not in detail, I would talk about just a few in more detail. So I want to talk about three cases. The first two are really about, and they're all Fourth Amendment cases. The first two cases are really about the substance of the Fourth Amendment, and they are Safford Unified School District versus Redding and Arizona versus Gantt. And then I'm going to talk about, the third case I'm going to talk about is Herring versus United States, and that's about the primary remedy for the Fourth Amendment, which is the exclusionary rule. Herring, interestingly, has been described by one scholar as possibly the most important Fourth Amendment case in the past 25 years. So let me talk about the other two cases first. In Safford Unified School District versus Redding, a middle school girl brought a damages suit against the school district under the Civil Rights Statutes, 42 U.S.C. 1983. She was alleging that a strip search for drugs had violated her Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches. Supreme Court held that the strip search did, in fact, violate her Fourth Amendment rights, but then the court went on to hold that because the law was not well established at the time that the violation occurred, the officials were immune from damages. Because of the immunity holding, the case was in some sense only a symbolic victory for Savannah Redding. Now, what I want to talk about, what I think is important in Safford, is not so much the holding, although that's important, but the way the Supreme Court got there. So the standard for searches of students in schools was set by the Supreme Court in a 1985 case called New Jersey versus TLO. In TLO, the principal had searched the purse of a student for cigarettes. The normal quantum of evidence that's required to do a search is probable cause, which means something like a fair probability that an officer will find evidence of crime in the place searched. But the court has held that because of the special needs of the school context, school administrators only need to have reasonable suspicion to do a search of school children. Now, one thing these two standards have in common, however, is that, at least in theory, the quantum of evidence required doesn't change depending on what the underlying infraction or crime is. In other words, regardless of the crime or infraction, whether it's possession of a small amount of marijuana or murder, the level of suspicion necessary to conduct the search is probable cause to believe the evidence of that crime would be found in the place search, or in the case of schools, reasonable suspicion. But there's some reason to think the court may be moving in a direction of a less monolithic Fourth Amendment. In its analysis of the reasonableness of the search in Safford, the Supreme Court seized on language from the earlier case, TLO. TLO had held that the school search is permissible if it's not, quote, excessively intrusive in light of the age and sex of the student and the nature of the infraction. Now, prior to Safford, lower courts had just simply ignored that language in determining whether a search was reasonable or not. In Safford, however, in analyzing the strip search, the Supreme Court noted that the search was for ibuprofen, an over-the-counter pain pill. The court faulted school officials for not considering whether the drugs were really dangerous or likely to be abused by students. Now, the Supreme Court has said that the school situation is special, so we can't necessarily apply wholesale the rules that apply to searches by police officers. But there are clues in other cases, too, that a number of members of the court, especially Justice Scalia, would like to move the court away from this more monolithic view of the Fourth Amendment to one that's more nuanced. The court's opinion in Arizona versus Gant may be another signal in this direction. Gant was an automobile search case. Prior to Gant, it was standard practice for police officers who stopped a car in a traffic stop to automatically do a search of the passenger compartment of the car. The rationale for this automatic search incident to arrest was that police need to be able to remove weapons, and they also need to be able to remove evidence that the arrestee is trying to destroy or hide. Despite this underlying rationale, however, the automatic search was considered lawful even if police officers had already secured the arrestee and stuck him in the patrol car. In other words, he was nowhere near the car and couldn't possibly access either weapons or evidence. By the time Gant came down, police officers viewed this vehicle search as an investigative tool because they could simply stop people for traffic offenses and then they'd get an automatic search incident to arrest in which they could look for other stuff. At least as a formal matter, Arizona versus Gant changed this. In Gant, the Supreme Court held that because the rationale for the search incident to arrest is safety, police may not search an automobile once an arrestee has been secured and can't access the interior of the vehicle. The only exception, and this is important, is if police have reason to believe there's evidence of the crime of arrest in the vehicle. As a majority acknowledged in a footnote, for all practical purposes, this holding means the end of vehicle searches during traffic stops. No police officer worth her salt would conduct a search of a vehicle while the arrestee was wandering around. Nor will she arrest and then leave the suspect within grabbing distance of the automobile. It's standard practice to order the suspect and any other occupants out of the car, to frisk them, handcuff them, and stick them in the patrolman's vehicle. At that point, however, there's no justification under Grant for doing a search incident to arrest. Now, while most of the reaction to Gant has focused on this first holding about search incident to arrest of the vehicle, the reason to believe holding is likely to be the one that really matters. The reason why the first holding probably doesn't matter is that police officers have all kinds of ways to get vehicle searches. As one police chief put it, The search incident to arrest is one tool, but we have lots of other tools left in our toolbox. But the real force of Gantt is the second holding, which permits police to search a vehicle only if they have reason to believe there's evidence of the crime of arrest in the vehicle. Prior cases had declined to make the search incident to arrest turned on the nature of the crime of arrest. For example, in Atwater versus Lago Vista, the Supreme Court rejected the argument that a search incident to arrest should not be permitted in connection with traffic offenses, minor traffic offenses like failing to wear your seatbelt. The practical effect of Gantt, however, is to make the distinction between traffic offenses and other kinds of offenses, because to make that distinction between traffic offenses and other kinds of offenses matter, because only the latter give rise to a vehicle search. In addition, for reasons that are too detailed to go into here, I believe that reason to believe doesn't mean probable cause, it means something less, probably something like reasonable suspicion. If so, this would be the first time that the Supreme Court has permitted a full search based on a quantum of evidence more like reasonable suspicion, in other words, less than probable cause. But more important, by drawing vehicle searches into its reasonable suspicion jurisprudence, the court's invoking a warrantless world in which the question to be asked is something like whether the search was reasonable under all the circumstances. Like the test in Safford, this balancing test invites questions such as whether the seriousness of the crime justified the scope of a particular search. Now, the last case I want to talk about is Herring versus United States, and that's, I would say, the most important of the three. The facts of Herring are straightforward. In July of 2004, Benny Herring went to the Coffee County, Alabama Sheriff's Department to receive some belongings from a car that had been impounded. As Herring was leaving, a police investigator decided to check and see whether there were any outstanding warrants against Herring, but the court clerk found none. So the investigator then asked her to check with her counterpart in a different county, Dale County. The clerk in Dale County reported that there was, in fact, an outstanding warrant for Herring's arrest. Based on this information, the police investigator then arrested Herring and conducted a search incident to arrest. The search revealed that he had methamphetamine on his person, and he had a gun in his vehicle. But unfortunately, less than 10 minutes after that first phone call, the Dale County clerk called to say that there wasn't, in fact, a warrant for his arrest. The warrant had been recalled 5 months earlier, but that recall had not been entered into the computer database. So after he was indicted, the defendant was indicted for illegal possession of the gun and drugs, Herring sought to exclude the gun and drugs on the ground that his arrest, and therefore the search, was illegal. The magistrate denied Herring's motion, and the trial in the appellate courts affirmed. The Supreme Court held that even if there was a Fourth Amendment violation, the evidence need not be suppressed because the illegality was from a negligent mistake rather than from deliberate or systemic misconduct. At a superficial level, Herring seems to be about how to handle clerical errors made by police officers. In order to understand why this very reasonable-sounding holding is more important than it sounds, I need to say something about the importance of the exclusionary rule in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. In the 1961 case of Mapp versus Ohio, the Supreme Court first held the exclusionary rule remedy applicable to claims in state court. Prior to Mapp, state enforcement officers simply disregarded the Fourth Amendment because there was no real sanction for violating it. The primary mode of enforcement before 1961 was a trespass action against the police officer, which defendants rarely brought and even more rarely won. When Mapp came down, it created a sea change in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. For the first time, state officers were required to know the rules and actually apply them, lest the evidence they worked so hard to gather would be excluded. But of course, there's another side of the coin of the exclusionary rule. Exclusion is costly. Evidence that's collected in violation of the Fourth Amendment is perfectly good evidence. It's not suppressed because it's unreliable. It's suppressed because it was gathered illegally. And the cost of suppressing such evidence is that the jury is deprived of perfectly good evidence against the defendant, and as a result, the defendant might go free. While the Mapp Court explicitly held that all evidence obtained by searches and seizures in violation of the Constitution must be suppressed, the cases that followed began to separate the right from the remedy. The court began to ask whether, in a particular context in which the exclusionary rule might apply, the marginal benefits of applying the rule in that context outweighed the cost. And the answer to that question was virtually always no. The benefits and additional deterrence of police misbehavior did not justify the costs. So the Supreme Court held that evidence gathered in good faith reliance on a warrant need not be suppressed. Evidence gathered in good faith reliance on an unconstitutional statute need not be suppressed. And evidence gathered in illegally due to a court clerk error need not be suppressed. But here's the important part. A big part of the rationale for this whole line of cases was that it involved mistakes by people other than police officers. The mistakes were made by magistrates or court clerks, and police officers were the innocent victims of those mistakes. In these contexts, the court said the exclusionary rule would have no deterrent effect because the officers were not the ones who had actually made the mistake. Herring is the first case in which the Supreme Court considered the question of whether the exclusionary rule should apply to errors by police officers. Supreme Court said no, and that's a big deal. The factual context at issue in Herring is quite narrow. The court is answering the question left open by an earlier case, namely, does it matter whether the error was made by a police officer or a judicial officer? The court concluded that the error that gave rise to the unconstitutional arrest of Benny Herring was the result of isolated negligence, attenuated from the rest. But here's the court's rule. To trigger the exclusionary rule, the police conduct must be sufficiently deliberate that exclusion can meaningfully deter it, and sufficiently culpable that such deterrent is worth the price paid by the justice system. If the court means what it says in that statement, there will be a lot less exclusion in future cases, and there's reason to think that it does. In an earlier opinion, Hudson versus Michigan, the Roberts Court signaled its intention to roll back the scope of the exclusionary rule. In Mapp, the Supreme Court had said, without the exclusionary rule, the Fourth Amendment might as well be stricken from the Constitution. In Hudson, the court described exclusion as a, quote, last resort. What a dramatic change in language. The Ninth Circuit has taken the Supreme Court's signal in Herring to heart. In a recent case, the Ninth Circuit found that police violated the Fourth Amendment when they searched a container in defendant's home without a warrant. But rather than assuming the evidence should be excluded, the court remanded the case so that the district court could consider the separate question of whether police actions were sufficiently deliberate and sufficiently culpable that the evidence should be suppressed. Now, I want to make one last point, which goes to the reason why Herring, if it ends up applying broadly to police mistakes, is a really big deal. As those of you who know, who have studied criminal investigation know, the scope of the remedy is the scope of the right. In other words, in situations in which the Fourth Amendment is violated but there's no exclusion, police officers view those situations as loopholes. So it's impossible to think about the scope of the right without thinking about the scope of the remedy. It follows, then, that if Herring narrows the kinds of cases in which exclusion applies, the effective reach of the Fourth Amendment will also shrink. Whatever side one is on in the debate over the exclusionary rule, this would be a very big deal.
So there are seats up front, if anybody wants to see standing. No? Right. Okay. I mean, it's getting pretty close, isn't it? So what I want to do today with you is survey the five environmental cases that the court decided in the 2008-2009 term, and then to focus on two of them as a deeper inquiry into what's going on in these cases and try to perpetuate or create a better understanding on all our parts as to the nature of the trend that the court seems to be creating here. So for environmentalists, there is good news and bad news in the record of the Roberts Court, if we're thinking about the Roberts Court as an entity. But if you look at environmental cases over the last 5 years, you get the good news and bad news story. The good news is that the court is taking more environmental cases, so that environmental cases are now a significant part of the court's caseload, five of the 75 cases in the most recent term. So finally, environmental cases are getting the recognition or the attention that they deserve, at least if you're an environmentalist. The bad news is that that attention is almost all negative. So in the most recent term, the 2008-2009 term, five environmental cases all were decided on anti-environmental positions. That is, the court adopted pro-business positions that were against environmental interests that were asserted in those cases. Also during that term, in these five cases, four were pro-government, one was anti-government. The four pro-government cases were all pro-business, and the one anti-government case was a case in which the government happened to be representing the environmental interests. So from this you get a sense, and a lot of commentators have noted it, that the Supreme Court is out to make a point about limiting or allowing the government to limit the scope and stringency of environmental protections. So the headline for my talk, you can determine for yourselves whether you want to accept or reject this headline, but the headline for my talk is Court Endorses Limits on Environmental Protections. And all the five environmental cases decided during this last term are parts of the story underneath that headline. These cases are a varied lot. I'm going to give you just a brief summary of the cases, then I'm going to focus on these two cases. The first case is Winter v. NRDC. In that case, the court vacated an injunction that the Ninth Circuit had upheld limiting the scope of Navy sonar testing to protect whales, right? The Navy goes out, it tests sonar equipment to detect foreign submarines, and that has an impact, disputed what extent that impact will be, but it has an impact on whales that, you know, navigate using sonar and get very disturbed sometimes if certain sonar signals are in the vicinity. So the court vacates that injunction on the grounds, there were several grounds, but one of the main ground was that national security interests represented by the Navy's testing far outweighed any environmental interest in protecting the whales. Just straight out. The court said there's no way it's reasonable to conclude that this national security interest has to give way to the whales. Now, that's bad if you're a whale person, but that's probably a predictable outcome, particularly in the post-9/11 atmosphere. Second case, this is a standing case, Summers v. Earth Island Institute. In that case, the court decided that environmentalists didn't even have a right to be in court. They lacked standing because they failed to assert the proper injury. The environmentalists were seeking review of certain forest service regulations relating to timber salvage sales, but they didn't get that review because the court said they didn't have the requisite injury. Again, that's not much of a surprise either, given the standing doctrine that has emerged in the recent history of the court, beginning with Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife. The last three decisions in environmental cases in this term are decisions in which the court is reviewing statutory interpretations or factual determinations by lower federal courts or by administrative agencies. And it's two of those decisions I want to look at. These tend to be the less glamorous decisions, right? They're not constitutional. They're not about injunctive relief, saving the whales, all that. These are more modest cases, if you will. But I think by looking at two of them, I can give you a sense of the trend that seems to be emerging in these cases, and that I think has long-term implications for environmental law. The first case is Entergy Corporation versus Riverkeeper, Inc. And that case involves a provision of the Clean Water Act, Section 316, a fairly narrow provision that deals with standards for cooling water intake structures in electric generating plants. Right? So how important is that? Well, Section 316 is intended, the purpose of it is to protect fish and shellfish that get impinged on or entrained in these cooling water systems for electric power plants. So that's significant, at least for the fish and shellfish, right? But the decision in this case under 316 is significant legally, I think, beyond the narrow confines of the case, because it creates additional room for agencies to use cost-benefit analysis and increases the scope of agency discretion in making decisions under statutes like the Clean Water Act. Cost-benefit analysis, as many of you may know, I'm sure, is a tool, an analytical tool that's used widely in the executive branch to analyze proposed regulations, but it is viewed very skeptically by environmentalists as skewing decisions in favor of economic interests, business interests, and against environmental interests and other health and safety interests. Now, Section 316 itself says nothing on its face about cost-benefit analysis. It requires that the agency set standards for these cooling water intake structures that reflect, and I quote, the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact. Best technology available. In adopting the regulation and adopting the standards under this section, EPA interpreted that language as allowing for the use of cost-benefit analysis to decide what the best available technology is. And using cost-benefit analysis, the agency selected standards that were less demanding on the electric utilities than would otherwise have been the case. So less protection for the fish in light of the additional costs that would have had to be proposed or that would have to be imposed in order to get to a higher level of protection. The rule, the standards that the agency adopted in this way were appealed to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit, in an opinion by then-Judge Sotomayor, sent the rule back to the agency. It was skeptical about the agency's use of cost-benefit analysis and wanted to know more about the basis of the agency's decision. That decision by the Second Circuit then was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed the Second Circuit and upheld the agency's rule, including the interpretation that cost-benefit analysis was permissible. And it did that in an opinion by Justice Scalia. Justice Breyer filed a concurring opinion, and Justice Stevens, joined by Justices Ginsburg and Souter, filed a dissenting opinion. The dissenting opinion said cost-benefit analysis is prohibited under this statutory provision. Just look at the language that says best available technology, and you'll figure that out. Quite different approach, quite different interpretation than Justice Scalia provided in his opinion for the court. This decision represents, I think, a demonstrable shift in the court's attitude toward cost-benefit analysis, in this case, but more generally. There was an earlier case that the court decided in 1981 called the American Textile Manufacturers Institute case, in which the court seemed to adopt a presumption against the use of cost-benefit analysis in cases like this, where the statute was silent on the issue. and Section 316 is silent on the issue. So if that presumption had ruled, had been adopted, cost-benefit analysis would be precluded in the silence of Section 316. And that's exactly the presumption that Judge Sotomayor, then Judge Sotomayor, followed in her Second Circuit opinion. And it's that presumption that Justice Scalia clearly rejects in upholding the agency's rule under Section 316. So this is a change. I would. It's a significant change, subtle perhaps, but significant, in the direction of more widely accommodating cost-benefit analysis in administrative practice. Why is that important? Well, it creates room for agencies to strike their own policy balance in the context of statutes that otherwise seem quite stringent in their commitment to remedial measures, as in the case of the Clean Water Act. Now, it may be good, right? I mean, there is a consistent practice within the executive branch of the United States to require cost-benefit analysis for rulemakings where not prohibited by statute. So this ruling does bring into line, really, the judicial presumptions in interpreting statutes with the agency, the existing administrative practice in the executive branch. So that's a good thing. Also, and Justice Breyer says this, is in concurrence, we may do, just by the way we are set up to think about problems, we may do cost-benefit analysis anyway. Even if we're not acknowledging it or it's not a matter of public record, we may not be able to resist the impulse of, in a rough way at least, comparing costs and benefits and deciding the relative balance of those. And we can imagine that doing that will avoid grossly irrational decisions. I know we still make grossly irrational decisions even when we balance costs and benefits, but maybe we're less likely to do so in that case. The downside, and this is what environmentalists stress, is that cost-benefit analysis tends to privilege those values that can be easily quantified and to disadvantage those values that cannot. So economic costs to the industry are going to be fully taken into account. Impact on non-marketable fish and shellfish, probably not. It's hard to put a dollar value on them. And at least to somebody, to the Riverkeeper Inc., they're important. Maybe they even have value in themselves. So that there is a balance here that continues to make this a difficult decision. The court doesn't resolve the broader dispute, obviously, but it shifts the court's position in that dispute, I think, palpably. And it increases the scope of the agency's discretion to make its own choices based on this balancing in the context of these remedial statutes. So am I doing okay for time?
You're coming right.
I'm coming. I got about a minute, and I have another case to go. All right. Well, this will be very quick. This is just another sort of vignette. 45 seconds now. Another vignette. I can't possibly do this. There's another case. Burlington Northern versus Santa Fe Railroad versus U.S., which is about Superfund, the Superfund statute, the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation and Liability Act, CERCLA. Which is a liability statute, different from the regulatory statute that we looked at under the Clean Water Act, right? The liability statute doesn't try to regulate anything. It just imposes damages if you conduct yourself in a certain way and cause harms. All right. So in this case, there was a site, a contaminated site, at which an operator, a chemical distributor, spilled chemicals on the ground. Right? That operator would be liable under Superfund as the operator of a site at which chemical contamination occurred. And that operator would be liable for um, the the cleanup costs, the cost of going in and correcting that that contamination. In this case, conveniently for the operator, it disappeared, right? No longer available at the time the government came to try to get the damages. So the only party that was available potentially for damages was a railroad, which happened to own part of the property on which this chemical company existed, and which leased that property to the operator of the chemical distribution operation. Under Superfund, you may not believe this, but under Superfund, that railroad company is liable also, even though it did not actively participate in the business of operating that chemical distribution. It's an owner of a property on which contamination occurred at the time that contamination occurred. And therefore, it is liable, it is strictly liable under Superfund, regardless of fault, and it may be jointly and severally liable under Superfund, unless it can show that the harm that was caused to the site, occasioning the cleanup, is reasonably divisible. And that's the apportionment issue under Superfund, and that was the issue that was front and center in this case, that whether the railroads could successfully argue that they weren't joint and severally liable, but were liable only for a small portion which could be attributed to their action and not for the whole idea. The lower courts in these apportionment cases have had a tradition of rejecting apportionment arguments by the private parties, the liable parties. The liable parties want apportionment because it limits their liability. The government is against apportionment because it is inimical to maximizing private contributions. And the lower courts have been complicit with the government in routinely rejecting requests by these private parties to apportion damages. Big important feature of the Superfund program, which is a big important feature of environmental law. And in this case, the Supreme Court says apportionment is the right thing to do. There's a reasonable factual basis for apportionment. It reverses the Court of Appeals ruling that held that apportionment was not available. And in that way, this is just a factual determination. It's not a big legal ruling. It's not a constitutional level issue. Just a little thing going on where the court says, you know, the facts here are enough already. And that nudges the lower federal courts into being much more receptive. My prediction is much more receptive on apportionment than they have been in the past. And that's exactly the way the environmental bar is taking this case. To them, it's a big case because they understand what the court is doing, understand what the court is signaling in this case. So what's my conclusion? You got two cases out of five cases, sort of all going the same way. In these two cases, I think our detailed examination shows that the court is moderating or is showing a tendency to moderate environmental requirements. It's showing a tendency to raise the importance, raise consideration of the burdens, of the economic burdens of environmental regulation, as well as consideration of the costs. That, in my view, is the clear trend. And if the trend continues, certainly in the robust way that it now seems to be going on, it's going to change, in the aggregate, the face of environmental law. Thank you.
I'm here to talk mainly about two civil rights cases. They are, I think, extraordinarily complicated. And since I see the reception is about to begin, instead of telling you everything about what the court did decide, I thought I would just tell you what they didn't decide. This makes my job so much simpler, and I hope makes this talk so much more informative for you. I think the trend of the Roberts Court and Supreme Court in civil rights cases is towards restricting civil rights legislation, but it is not a uniform trend, and it is easy to name cases in which the court has expanded those rights. I don't think that's true of the two cases I'm going to talk about today. One concerns affirmative action. It's the New Haven firefighters case, Ricci against DeStefano. There, the court indirectly limited certain forms of affirmative action. But it's very important to note, the court did not strike down all forms of affirmative action. And as Dick Howard pointed out, it did not rest its decision on constitutional grounds. The second case concerned a key provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which imposed onerous burdens mainly on governments in the South if they wanted to change any of their voting requirements. If they wanted to do that, they had to seek the approval of the Attorney General or a three-judge federal court in Washington, D.C. This provision was first passed in 1965. It was extended for 5 years. Most recently, in 2006, it's been extended for 25 years. The court narrowly interpreted this provision but did not strike it down. Again, what we have is a narrowing of civil rights law, but not a constitutional decision. So let me say just a little bit about both of these cases. Ricci against DeStefano, the New Haven firefighters case, is in fact doctrinally extremely complicated. And it would take me the better part of an hour just to orient you with the relevant doctrine. But let's just look at the facts. So the facts are these. New Haven wanted to promote certain of its firefighters to higher level positions. It administered a test to do so. It was a written paper and pencil test. All of those who passed the test were white, with the exception of two Hispanics. The city looked at this result and it said, we've got a problem here. The problem in legal terms is that under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, they could be held liable under a doctrine of discriminatory effects if the test in its effects, not in its intent, but just in its operation, significantly worked to the disadvantage of blacks and Hispanics who wanted a promotion. They could have been held liable under the Civil Rights Act. The city responded to this problem by discarding the results of the test and saying we're going to start all over again. But that just put them in a bigger bind, because now the whites and one of the Hispanics who passed the test sued and said, you just discriminated against us on the basis of our race. So the city, in my judgment, found itself in a very bad position very early on in this case. If they kept the test results, they were liable under the Civil Rights Act. And if they discarded the test results, they were liable under the Civil Rights Act. The Supreme Court eventually held they were liable under the Civil Rights Act. Now, one key feature of the progress of this decision is Judge Sotomayor, in the Court of Appeals, would have held that the city was not liable. And so the case was closely followed because it tracked her votes and perhaps her views on the question. Now, let me emphasize some features of the Supreme Court's decision. First, it was an opinion by Justice Kennedy with the usual right-left division on the court. Five of the, you know, typically described conservative justices voting with Justice Kennedy, four dissenting liberal justices voting with Justice Ginsburg. Secondly, Justice Kennedy says right out at the beginning of his opinion, I'm not deciding any constitutional question. Now, this is a bit of a fudge on his part, because if you read the opinion closely, you see quotations and standards lifted from constitutional cases. But it is strictly a Title VII case. And one way to summarize the result in the Title VII case is this. An employer who's in the position of the city of New Haven with a risk of a lawsuit for discriminatory effects by members of minority groups and the risk of a lawsuit by members of the majority group, men or whites, for intentional discrimination has got to pay more attention to the risk of intentional discrimination. So the court takes the doctrines that support prohibitions against explicitly considering race and sex in employment decisions and says those are more important than the doctrines that prohibit practices with discriminatory effects. Now, the story is really a lot longer than that. But let me say one more thing about the case. It doesn't use the phrase affirmative action. The closest the court comes is in this one passage, which I will now read to you. It's only the part of a sentence. A minimal standard could cause employers to discard the results of lawful and beneficial promotional examinations, even when there is little, if any, evidence of adverse effects. That would amount to a de facto quota system. So the court doesn't decide the constitutional question, doesn't mention affirmative action, except in this one place where it says, be careful about making decisions based on worries about discriminatory effects. You might be really trying to establish a quota. Now, that's the broad outline of the decision. One of the important features of it, however, is how limited it is. It only applies to employers who are in the situation of the city of New Haven. It doesn't apply to any employer who's considering, you know, whether to use a testing procedure in the first place. Why not use a much more flexible method of evaluating people for promotions? So the court's decision is quite narrow, but nevertheless, this suggestion is very strong. Be very careful about affirmative action plans. Be very careful about justifying your practices because you're worried about lawsuits based on discriminatory effects. Now, the second case, which I'll just talk about briefly, is under the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And to give you an idea of how technical it is, all you have to do is read the title of the case. Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District against Holder. Well, when one thinks about voting rights, you think about, you know, great issues of participation in American civil life. You don't really sit down and think about, you know, who gets to vote for whom in a small utility district. And when you think about discrimination on the basis of race in voting, what you think about is the pervasive disregard of the 15th Amendment, one of the great amendments to the Constitution, during the era of Jim Crow. The 15th Amendment prohibits racial discrimination in voting against citizens of the United States. Now, the Northwestern Austin Municipal Utility District did not have its roots in Reconstruction. It was created in 1987, when most of Jim Crow had been abandoned. So that the disproportion between sort of the grand issues of voting rights and racial equality and this recently established municipal district already give a clue that perhaps the law should not be brought down very hard on a government unit which didn't even exist until the mid-1980s. Now, the doctrinal evidence on this question, as I said, is quite intricate. The key provision in the Voting Rights Act is this provision requiring government units, mainly in the South, to get special pre-clearance, as it's called, of any change in their voting procedure. And the rationale behind it is that many government districts discriminated against blacks by constantly changing their rules to avoid judicial injunctions against discrimination and to keep blacks disenfranchised. This provision was designed to combat that. If you want to change any procedure, if you want to move a polling station, you go up to Washington and get it cleared. So it was a draconian provision, and as Chief Justice Roberts emphasizes in his opinion for the court, it was also greeted with some hostility in the South, because it applied mainly in the South. So it was regarded as non-uniform federal legislation, punishing certain regions in the country and letting others off scot-free. That's not an accurate description of how the Act actually operates. In fact, it applies in parts of New York City. But it's important to realize the source of resentment in the Act's application. Now, the utility district, you know, tried to get out from under the Act in two ways. One, they said, there's a special complicated procedure under the Act where we can escape its coverage. This is called a bailout provision. But it would have been virtually impossible for the school, for the utility district, to accomplish bailout under a literal reading of the statute. They would have to show that all of Texas could be bailed out. And they're this tiny little utility district. The second claim they brought is that this statute, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, is unconstitutional. And this major piece of modern civil rights legislation should be struck down. Now, that is a startling claim. In the Supreme Court, it was accepted only by Justice Thomas. Chief Justice Roberts said, we are going to rewrite the statute to avoid this constitutional question. And the way they did it, which is very complicated, is basically to say, we're going to make it a lot easier for governments that are covered by this provision to get out from under it, notwithstanding the literal terms of the statute, which Chief Justice Roberts pretty much disregards. But what he accomplishes is that he avoids the constitutional question. So let's just stop and think for a moment about these two cases. In one, the court narrowly interprets the Civil Rights Act to emphasize intentional discrimination, not discriminatory effects. In the other, it rewrites the Voting Rights Act in order to avoid a constitutional question. In both cases, the court lets major civil rights legislation stand. Now, this emphasizes another point that Dick Howard made in his introduction. This is a very incrementalist decision. Believe me, declaring the Voting Rights Act of 1965 unconstitutional would not have been incremental. It would have been earth-shaking. But the Roberts Court, I think, is trying to send a signal, as it did at the end of the opinion. And let me just read that one passage. And it really resonates with the times that we have now, particularly after the election of President Obama. So Chief Justice Roberts says, more than 40 years ago, this court concluded that exceptional conditions prevailing in certain parts of the country justified extraordinary legislation otherwise unfamiliar to our federal system. In part due to the success of that legislation, we are now a very different nation. It's a warning that he gives to Congress. You know, you really should have thought a little harder before you extended the Voting Rights Act in 2006 for another 25 years. Now, I think, you know, these signals that the Roberts Court is sending, I think, are very important. I think some of them are really quite salutary. I'm not a fan of the Roberts Court. I don't applaud their restrictions on civil rights. But to the extent that they want to establish a dialogue with Congress, to send warnings to Congress to repair legislation rather than to declare it unconstitutional, I think that's a step forward in our Constitution.